You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Good morning, and welcome to Let's Talk Movies with Moira and Shannon. I'm Shannon.
I'm Moira.
So thrilled to be here with you guys. I want to let you know we postponed from last Wednesday because, as you can hear, I've been slightly under the weather, and I just want to thank Moira and Chris for being so patient and all of you for being so patient. But I'm back. I'm alive. I'm here.
Yay!
And we're going to be talking about movies. We're live right now, and we'd love to have your input. I have a feeling from things that got said this morning, it might get a little heated, but I just want everybody to know, you know, nobody's going to get injured. Moira and I have ultimate respect for each other, but we don't always agree on things, and we'll see how that goes. In particular I've been waiting to talk about for a while. But we're live right now on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, about a dozen other sites. Our wonderful, fabulous Chris Desmond, who I thank the heavens for on a daily basis, is going to show you some of the different ways that you could be connecting. If you're asking yourself, why are the two ladies here on the Autism Network talking about movies? Because people who are on the spectrum and people who love people on the spectrum love to talk about a variety of different things, first of all. But oddly enough, a lot of the things that we see end up coming back to, relating to, and I think we're going to be talking a little bit about that today, maybe, it's possible. It could happen, because Hollywood seems to be working its way through when people are different and when people look at things different. So that's certainly why, but it also gives us an opportunity to have this fun and a forum in which the lovely Moira Giamatteo can tell us what's happening with Taka. So I'm going to let her do that, but first I'm going to just tell you, if you're watching us on Facebook, YouTube, or Twitter, you can be writing in right now, and there's Rodney. Hello, Rodney. Thank you for sharing. And we can answer your questions about really anything. I feel like I've forgotten 35 things to say, but let's keep it short today.
Yeah, we'll
so,
keep it short.
Moira, what's happening at Taka?
What's happening at Taka? If you don't know, Taka is the Autism Community in Action, and they are going to launch for Autism Awareness Month, Autism Action Month, Autism Acceptance Month, whichever flavor you want, our virtual conference. And there's going to be a lot of content available throughout the month of April. I believe the price for that is only $35. There are scholarships available. If that is a stretch, we have funding for scholarship registration. I believe Regional Center also would cover it. But
if you're in California.
If you're in California. And you will have access, included in your registration will be access to the recorded sessions, the presentations. The live Q&A sessions will not be recorded just for privacy's sake, just in case people ask questions that they maybe don't want, you know, out there in perpetuity.
Yes.
The recorded sessions will be available for, I believe, until May 31st, so you can binge them at your leisure until May 31st. And so starting kickoff with Autism April and all that fun stuff.
I got to say, too, I say this on a regular basis. If you are wanting to know more, if you are feeling like stuck, like you don't know where you're going next, if you are feeling paranoid, like maybe there's more progress for you or someone you love on the spectrum, and you just don't know what steps to take next, or if you just feel like, I don't know, my battery is dead, and I just, I don't know if I can do this much longer, going to a Taka conference, virtual or in person, is your answer.
Yep.
You're going to get answers. You're going to get direction. You're going to get support. You're going to get your battery charged. There's nothing like it. And I say this all the time, and I get no kickback. None whatsoever. But I experienced it as a parent, and I've told so many people, and everybody says the same thing. It's life-changing. It's life-changing. They've got their virtual conference coming in April, and what they need to know what to sign up.
You just go to the website, talkanow.org, and you can find a registration button and register for it. And again, if we didn't hear it before, there are scholarships available. Registration is only $35, a pretty good bargain, and you get to watch the recorded presentations for a couple of months after after April. I think it goes through May. Not a couple of months, 1 month.
There we go.
Like, wait a minute. But I wanted to, for the movie fans out there, if you can see me, tell me the pattern that I'm wearing. And then for those that are listening to later, I'm wearing a shirt that says Rollo Tomasi. And that is another movie, a different movie reference. So my outfit is two sort of movie references. So if you're listening later, you know, Rollo Tomasi, if you go, I know that. You're like me, a movie nerd. So,
and I'm going to hope I don't cough. We had like 5 minutes when we were down, and I could have coughed that whole time, but no. No, it waited for you.
Yeah. Aren't you lucky?
All right. We're going to launch in and talk about some movies.
Let's do it.
As much as we possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. Okay. What's our first movie up for bid?
Go ahead. The Holdovers. The Holdovers is a film with Paul Giamatti, directed by Alexander Payne, and of course starring, like I said, Paul Giamatti, Divine Joy Randolph, Dominic Sessa, and Kerry Preston. So Paul Giamatti plays a tough-as-nails teacher at a private boys' school who gets stuck with babysitting the students who are not able to go home for the holidays over the winter break. It takes place during the Vietnam War, and one of the alumni of the school has been a casualty of that war. The mother of that alumni, played by Divine Joy Randolph, is working at the school as a cook. So she's there as well as Paul Giamatti to take care of these kids that can't get home. They're privileged and spoiled young white boys who I think if they were to be expelled from the school would get drafted into Vietnam. So that's something the kids are not really aware of, but I think the adults are very aware of it. And after a few days of this purgatory of being a holdover, one of the boys' families offers to pick them up via helicopter and take them all skiing. All boys but one are able to get parental permission to leave, so now we have only one holdover, and then, of course, Paul Giamatti, the teacher and the cook. And they kind of form this little broken family trying to get through the holidays and through the heartache. And, you know, Paul Giamatti is always worth watching. I have no regrets ever of any film I've watched him in. It was a wonderful discovery to discover Miss Randolph. And the young man, Dominic Sessa, was good in an unlikable role because he was a little bit of a brat. But ultimately, I just thought it was okay. It didn't wow me. I was glad to see this smaller movie about human interaction and on a small scale being recognized. But it didn't, like, blow me away. I just thought, okay, I enjoyed that. But it didn't really stick with me. But what were your thoughts, Madeir?
Yeah, through the cough. Forgive me, everyone, especially you.
No worries.
I thought that Paul Giamatti's performance was remarkable. Mm-hmm. I was worried for the actor.
Mm.
I looked at him and I was like, oh, man, Paul Giamatti is not well.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? Like, that's how deeply I was, like, believed his performance. And I was like, and I was Googling what is wrong with his eyes and they've had discussions with him in interviews, and he's like, I'm not going to give away how he did that.
Yeah, because he kind of has a wall, they call it a wall eye or one eye, wandering eye. Yeah.
It's a really good performance.
It is.
And Divine Joy Randolph, her performance, I thought was truly amazing. The young kid, I thought he did really well for holding his own in what is really like his first or second film with these two, like, performances. I thought the pacing of it was a little slow.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that the, you know, wasn't that poofy, you know?
Right.
The realization, we don't want to give anything away. But I, you know, I thought it was a really good example of a character-driven small film.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad that it's getting recognition. I'm glad that Paul and Divine are getting recognition. I'm okay with it getting a Best Picture nom, but it's, you know, I don't think it's earth-shattering.
Right.
But it's a really solid, good movie that you can sit and watch and be like, okay, that was a good movie.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it changed anybody's life.
Right.
But I think Paul Giamatti's performance is pretty, pretty, like, remarkable.
Yeah. Yeah. No, he's
so
incredible.
A solid film, but, you know, a little underwhelming.
Yeah. That's kind of the way I felt, and I felt like the helicopter coming in was a very convenient plot device.
Yeah.
How do we make these three people?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The script's a little weak.
Yeah.
We got all kinds of things happening. Lights flashing. you know, okay.
It's haunted.
It's like it's we've haunted. Got something. I always say when it's electrical, it's my mom.
Oh.
Mom, nice. What is it you want? And notice that she just,
Just nodded at
tell
you.
Me, Mom. Okay. All right.
All right, next film is Naiad. And this is a biopic about Diana Nyad and her attempt to swim from Cuba to Florida. And it's director Jimmy Chin, Elizabeth Chai Vasahali.
Good.
Did I do that right? I'll
give you a gold star.
Annette Bening plays Nyad. Jodie Foster plays her partner, Bonnie. And then Reese Ifans is the captain of the boat that's following her and part of the team. Now, this is more what I expected from a biopic of, you know, we were talking about that before with Maestro. I felt like this is kind of more like she's got this goal she's trying to achieve that's really difficult. And it was a little more clear cut to me. I have to say, though, the movie belongs to Jodie Foster. You know, she's amazing. She makes it look so easy, but her quiet determination in the face of all this force of nature-driven athlete, she just quietly takes over the whole thing. And she's wonderful. You're just compelled to watch her. I don't really have much to say except that it is kind of more what I think about as in terms of a biopic. But it accomplished what I feel like Maestro didn't for me. It was more about those that support the person with the dream than about the person with the dream. You know, so I thought, I mean, it's, you know, they're very different, obviously, but that was kind of what I took away from it. I'm like, oh, okay, I think that was more what I was expecting from Maestro. But Jodie Foster, oh my gosh, I'm so glad she's doing more things again because she is just amazing. And we were talking, I'm watching True Detective right now, and whew, I'm loving it. So, yeah, so that's kind of where I landed on that. How about you?
I'm not sure we can be friends
anymore. Oh, no!
If you're going to compare this to Maestro and have it come out better, I'm not sure, Moira. I'm going to have to overlook that for you. Because to me, like, Maestro is so clearly this work of art, and this is a... you know,
TV movie of the week.
Yeah,
mm-hmm,
exactly.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Thank you. Okay,
mm-hmm.
We can be friends.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. But here's the thing. I am a huge Annette Bening fan. Annette Bening is the reason why I got to go to graduate school.
Yeah.
I auditioned for her and her husband, and she sat me down and was like, girl. And I went to graduate school, and she told all the people she's coming, and she was just took care of me in terms of that. And left. She was performing at the Denver Center Theater Company and left to go to New York. Stole my monologue, by the way. and used my monologue, apparently, when auditioning for Coastal Disturbances. That might be urban myth, but this is what I've heard. Anyway, which she got nominated for a Tony for. So I have true love for Annette Bening and feel like she's been someone in my life. She's a brilliant actress.
Mm-hmm.
And I would throw down with anybody to have them say otherwise. Here's what happened. She's too good of an actress for this movie. Because you have this Diana Nyad, who people my age, I'm older than you are, people my age may remember Diana Nyad, is this very abrasive person
mm-hmm.
who had a very abrasive voice, and she, you know, she wasn't a warm, fuzzy person, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the vast majority of people don't remember. Mm-hmm. And if they hadn't shown clips of her at the end, you wouldn't remember that. And it didn't even show how abrasive she is. Mm-hmm. But because Annette Bening is such a good actress, she studied Diana Nyad, and what she does is a really good interpretation of Diana Nyad. But you just can't like her.
Mm.
She's just not likable.
Mm.
And that is partially why Jodie Foster wins this movie, because she is the only reason why you will continue watching this crazy woman who's going to go back in the water, because Jodie Foster's character believes in her.
Mm-hmm.
And Jodie Foster is, as you said, quietly takes over this movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's really a feat what Annette Bening does, but it's not really infinitely interesting to watch.
Mm-mm. Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And I fault her for being too good of an actress and the directors for not going, hey, let's pull back on that a little bit.
Dial it down
because,
a notch. Yeah.
Because, you know, it's not about impersonating the person. It's about showing the humanity of this person.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a humanity there. I feel like they missed the boat. Mm-hmm. I thought it was an interesting movie, and it's worth watching for Jodie Foster, who is absolutely phenomenal. And I, too, am happy that she's having this resurgent. I feel like she's having the Jean Smart year.
Yes, yes.
Where it's like, oh, girl. When people start saying, well, if you're over 40 in Hollywood, everybody needs to shut up about that. Because you can have a career. Jean Smart and Jodie Foster have shown us how.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's how. But all in all, you know, I mean, it's an interesting movie, but it's a little bit like, oh, God, we got to watch her do it one more time. It gets painful. You know? And I, so I didn't feel this big triumph and, like,
Yeah, I just like watching Jodie react.
Yeah, Jodie makes it worth it.
That's the reason to watch it.
Yep. Yep, it is. And she's nominated with good cause. Mm-hmm. Okay, on to the next one.
We're going to start to wade in. Yes, Anatomy of a Fall, directed by Justine Triet, starring Sandra Hüller, Milo Machado Granier, Swan R. Lode, and I'm so sorry, and Messi the dog.
Who I think wins the
film. Oh, the dog.
He won at Cannes.
Did he?
Yes,
oh,
he won the Palme de Dog, whatever that is. There's an award for an animal.
Oh,
yes.
Good for him. He deserved it. Now, the plot of this film is super simple, and yet so much is happening. It's about a married couple that live in a chalet that's under construction with their son, you know, they're with their son and their dog in a beautiful area in France. The husband ends up dead outside on the snowy ground. Did he fall? Was he pushed? And as a lover of true crime, this film was right up my alley. And as they go through the process of the police investigation and the eventual trial, we're learning more about the tensions in the house, the ambiguities that exist in perception, and the small cruelties that only married couples can know and can inflict on each other. Family history comes out. I feel like it's a study of regret, resentment, guilt, projection, basically all the components of human history, I mean human existence. And I love that it's in both French and English. And the woman, the wife that Sandra Hüller is German, and she speaks both French and English, and there's the dynamic there where she's not as comfortable in France, and the reason she's in France is because that's where her husband wanted. You know, so there's a lot of stuff brewing under the surface, and I loved this. I loved the European feel of this, and I feel like were they to cast this as an American film, they would cast somebody like Amy Adams, who I love, but who I feel like would not be right, but she would give you that doe-eyed vulnerability that Sandra Hüller did not, you know, and I kind of loved that because she was so contained, and the true crime fans will know this. Often lawyers say the best story wins, if like the way that you can present the story to the jury is the one that wins. But what is fact and what is fiction, we don't know, you know, and it's great. So I don't know what you felt about this.
Oh my God, I thought it was so boring.
Really?
Oh, it's horrible. I just feel like I want to go back and ask. I mean, I love that you loved it, because then I can say to you, what on earth? This won the Palme d'Or. In addition to the dog winning, it won Palme d'Or at Cannes, and I was like, And I went, why? What else were they showing? And I looked at it and I was like, oh, okay, maybe that's why. But it's just worse than watching paint dry. I would rather watch paint dry. I'll tell you, my husband and I sat down to watch it, and we were like, oh. And maybe 15 minutes in, both of us were asleep.
Really?
And we went, oh, okay, well, that's not a fair look at this film. So let's come back to it. We came back to it again, and he said, I just feel like there's other things I want to do with my life.
Really? Wow.
And I was like, well, I got to watch it to the end because I'm going to review it. And I made it to the end, and he said to me, did anything really happen? I was like, you know, like, at a certain point, I guess it got a little interesting, but no, not really. I just thought it was, I mean, there was some good acting in it, and there was one line that's really memorable for me that I've quoted a couple of times, but no, this is, like, so boring to me, like, just worse than watch. I'd rather watch Charles in Charge.
Oh, no.
I'm just saying.
Shannon.
Yes, and everybody's gone on and on. But what I love is every time she's won an award, and I sit there going, okay, people did not watch these movies if this is winning an award. And every time she's gotten up, she's been so surprised. And she said, you know, we were like in a chalet and we started having this conversation and we decided we would do this film and we didn't think anybody would like it. She's like, it's just a shock to us that it's winning this many. And I'm like, you and me, honey, I'm as shocked as you are. It's just boring with a capital B.
Wow.
Ooh, well, not even a capital B. It's not even interesting enough to give it a capital B. I don't understand.
Well. Agree to disagree.
We're not going to be friends.
We're
with
not.
This
I know this.
We haven't even gotten.
I think we've got back to back.
But I will say
challenges here.
I will say that there's a character. There's the character of the son in this, and part of what was interesting to me is the discussion about, you know, that he has some difficulties.
Yes.
And how was that? What was the guilt thing between
yes.
the parents? I thought that was the most interesting part of the movie.
Yeah, like I said, felt like it was a study in the, like, scenes, you know, behind the scenes of a marriage.
I don't want to study. I'd rather be entertained. I don't know. I'm funny that way.
Well, okay. Let's the next one is going to be interesting.
Ooh, here we go.
The Zone of Interest, directed by Jonathan Glazer, starring, once again, Sandra Hüller. And as the
She's
wife.
She's having a year.
She is having a year. And then Christian Friedel, I'm going to say. Or might be Friedel. I always forget with German which one you pronounce first. So now I'm a huge fan of Sandra Hüller. This movie's about a family where a mom creates a perfect, beautiful home, gorgeous garden. A dad's trying to distinguish himself at his job and work his way up in the company. The twist, he's the commandant of Auschwitz, and their beautiful home shares the garden wall with the concentration camp. I read a review of this film on RogerEbert.com, and they used the phrase, the banality of evil. And that clearly was a major theme. I also read an article in the Smithsonian magazine about the real family the story is based on. Apparently, the film departs from the source material because that was slightly fictionalized. And I'm glad they did this. They portrayed the real guy. And he, Haas, I think was his name. And he was the actual commandant of Auschwitz. And he was responsible for the horrifically and efficiently murdering hundreds and thousands of Jews. So not great. But this film is demanding of its viewer. It starts with a dark screen and discordant music, and the title fades very, very slowly. And at one point, the blank screen was there so long, I thought, did the film break? And then I thought, no, it's digital. We're at AMC, you know, and they don't use film. So it's really demanding. It's not going to be for everyone. But you end up lulled by the day-to-day, and the beautiful yard, and the dad telling bedtime stories, all the while, the background. This film should win for sound design.
Oh, yes.
100%. I'm getting chills thinking of the way that they incorporate. It's always there. But you're watching it and seeing this family living their best life, and there's just these stark images and smoke constantly billowing and the smoke of the trains arriving. I mean, it's, and you never see any of the atrocities, and that's why I think the sound design is so important. And some, my husband, for one, felt like it made its point within the first 15 minutes. Did we have to go through all of this? But I liked, well, it's hard to like a movie about Nazis, but I liked that we were forced to be there. Because I do feel, and I feel like it was almost more impactful than seeing the atrocities, seeing the way in which it was just casually not a big deal, you know? And I'm like, and that's the and I think, again, with my true crime thing, there's always people who say, oh, this person that committed this was pure evil. And I'm like, yeah, but they're human, and that's what we need to know. Is that we need to watch. I mean, it's always like, never forget, right? Yeah. These were normal people that were just, you know, yeah. Terrifying, difficult, important. That's what I say.
Well, I'm going to use the word brilliant. Mm-hmm. This is a hard movie. Mm-hmm. This is not, I mean, I just said I don't want to study, I want to be entertained. This is not that movie, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
But this is art. This is beautiful in a horrible, twisted, unbelievably inappropriate way. It's hard to watch.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I can see why your husband was like, oh gosh. Because
mm-hmm.
it's very Brechtian in that, you know, it keeps pulling you back.
Back.
And twisting the knife and asking you to remember where you are, who you are, and what the hell's going on in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Now.
Mm-hmm.
In this really crazy juxtaposition. It's horrifying.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you, I mean, I couldn't help myself afterwards. I was like, this can't be real.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you read some of the accounts of his real children.
Mm-hmm.
you know, about what it was like growing up
mm-hmm.
with, you know, and the ovens being lit and.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's horrifying.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely horrifying, but the film is brilliant. And I don't know what else to say about that. I will tell you that it's, if you're somebody who's really sensitive, you're going to have a hard time watching it. But it's very effective in nailing down this message of, you know, there were these people who were acting like they were normal and
mm-hmm.
acting like it's okay, but they I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I understand that people can be indoctrinated into thinking it's okay,
mm-hmm.
but that's what we all have to be vigilant about,
mm-hmm.
is that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we watched the Super Bowl last night, and there was one commercial on the Super Bowl, and I found myself sitting there. It said that, you know, one in four Jewish Americans has been, I don't know what word they use, but has in some way...
been a victim of a hate crime?
But I don't know what the phrase was that they use has in some way been the victim of that kind of a thing. And I was like, is that true?
Mm-hmm.
That one in four here in America? You know, and then I think back to this movie. Look, we live in really horribly interesting times,
mm-hmm.
right? That Chinese curse.
Mm-hmm.
This is an important film.
Mm-hmm.
It's an important film. I won't say it's an easy film, but it is impeccably done.
Yes.
I've read a lot from the sound designer about how they did what they did. And, you know, they know they will win the Oscar or I will tear the building down.
Yeah, yeah. My daughter actually went to see it the other night and she pointed out things in it that I had not noticed. And
yeah.
particularly about the sounds and things. And I'm like, oh, God.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a tough one. But like I said, important.
Very important.
And
though.
Art. Like
and
you
it's
said,
a piece of art.
Yep. Yeah. Absolutely.
It's a piece of art. It's a piece of history. It, you know, it's an
mm-hmm.
important film.
Yep.
Hard, very disturbing.
Yep.
But stuff we have to face.
Right. Right.
And so.
Yep.
Now.
We're moving on. And the next one. Poor Things. And this is where I don't know. Shannon.
It's going to get ugly.
This is a film about Bella, played by, of course, its director is Yorgos Lanthimos, and Emma Stone is Bella. Mark Ruffalo and Willem Dafoe and Rami Youssef are in this, among other folks. And Bella is the character Emma Stone plays. She's a product of an experiment that Willem Dafoe's character, Dr. Godwin Baxter, literally called God by his creation, Bella, he's transplanted. I was debating on whether or not to spoil this, but I think that in order to have our discussion, we kind of...
There's a little bit of a spoiler alert, we have to say. It's like you find out like maybe 20 minutes into the film.
Yeah.
So if you don't want to know what we're going to say, then you need to turn the sound down now. So yeah. You've been warned.
Yep.
Spoiler alert coming.
Spoiler alert, and then I'll raise my hand when it's done. The Bella's experiment is that he has transplanted the brain of the baby that was in her, that was almost full term when she committed suicide, and transplanted that into the brain of the mother, you know, and so therefore Bella is an infant. So anyway, so she's a complete blank slate, innocent, and we were watching as she's discovering the world. And the world she's born into is a fantasy version of Victorian era London. And the time frame, I feel, is very important, and the fantasy representation of it, I think, is important. This is not a film for everyone, as I'm sure you will tell me. I loved it, and I saw it as a companion piece to Barbie in a weird way. There are similar themes in both, but in Barbie, she was a plastic doll with no genitals, so therefore exploring sexuality was not part of her journey. But for Bella, it was. And for the first part of the film, it made me very, very uncomfortable. But it was supposed to. She's a childlike woman in a woman's body, object of desire by the men in the film. And, however, she has no shame imposed upon her by the Victorian-era morals. She's free from, in my opinion, she's free from shame, and she's frank about what she wants. And Mark Ruffalo plays this creepy dude, but ultimately he ends up being kind of a tantruming baby man, and she's kind of using him. And what I loved about it being presented in a fantasy world with the main character in danger, but her lack of shame kind of liberates her in a way. And I that's a theme that I'm very interested in, about shame making you vulnerable, particularly within the framework of either religion or society or whatever your gender role is supposed to be. Shame makes you blame yourself. And it reminded me of what Margaret Atwood said about her book, The Handmaid's Tale. She said that what happened to women and girls in her book has happened or is happening to women and girls now. And I felt like the same could be said for Poor Things. But it's this world, the men are trying to control women and own these women's bodies, but Bella's not of that world, and she has independence. It's uncomfortable, but like Bella, Emma Stone is in charge and owns her own body. That's the way I viewed it.
Yeah, I think that's the way a lot of people viewed it. Mm-hmm. I think it's impossible for me to view this. First of all, let me say that I hated this movie. This movie offended me so much, and I think in my review I said that it's beautiful production design, mm-hmm. absolutely stunning, beautiful production design, some amazing costumes when they allow Emma Stone to wear clothes. But that everything else about this movie I would like to shove not only into the ocean but through the front door of the Fukushima power plant. Mm-hmm. Because I find it very, very offensive, and I feel like it normalizes some things that really should not be normalized. Okay, so let's start with the idea that the premise, first of all, the movie opens and you don't really understand what's happening. And here is this young, beautiful young woman who, though, cannot walk, talk, and feed herself appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't understand what her deal is in mm-hmm. the beginning. But it seems clear that there is something developmentally not on track
mm-hmm.
with this young woman and her understanding of the world and what's going on. I'm very sensitive to that.
Mm-hmm.
As a parent of somebody who had a developmental disability, I think we all, we want to rush to protect this person. And, like 5 minutes in, they use the R word
mm-hmm.
in conjunction with sexualizing her.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Like, you want to take the gloves off and start offending me? That would be how you would do it.
And I think that was intentional.
Yeah. Oh, I do too.
Mm-hmm.
I do too.
Mm-hmm.
Because then we're going to get into a thing where, as she begins to progress, very quickly they explain to us what has happened, that it's the baby that's been put in the mother's body. So now what you said to me in this film is, this is a child. This is a child. Now, sexuality, we know, comes at birth. Sexuality, and that no one should be ashamed of sexuality, but what do we do with children? Do we say, when you're having a sexual feeling, well, here, go with this man, and I'm going to allow him to do whatever, because, and here's the other part of it, is that sexuality in children feels good. When people are predators, they feed on that. That, it, you know, well, the child wanted it. The child, you know. The child doesn't have shame about it, and the child was enjoying it. This is what I hear from predators, pedophiles. And here we have, now they could have fixed this very easily for me. They could have, in the script, if they wanted to avoid this kind of controversy, all they would have said is, but they couldn't because it didn't fit with what they were trying to say. Well, now her brain is 18 years old. Now she can choose for herself. But until her brain is 18 years old, and until she has an understanding of the world, we're not going to allow predators to come and get her. But she's born into this world where the God character talks about how, for the sake of science, how basically, you know, he horrible abuse. Not just to his face, but sexual abuse.
Well, he was abused. His history is his abuse.
So
as
he
well.
Thinks nothing of letting her be abused by somebody else.
But she chooses to leave. That's the other thing. I mean, I know
with
that
a predator.
Yeah.
Yes. But she chooses to leave with a predator.
Yes.
So let's just back up for a second. Let's talk about right to consent and diminished understanding of what you're consenting to. We have rules in our society. Our society says that you don't have the right to enter a contract until you're 18. The rules of our society say that an adult cannot take a child and have sex with them, even if supposedly the somebody who's under 18 consents. That's statutory rape. That's what that is. That's what this movie is about. It's about predators and statutory rape. And everybody says, but she's empowered. She enjoys it. I cry bullshit.
See, I don't agree. I think that she does take agency over her own body, and that's the whole thing. Everybody else is trying to control her body, and she, yes, you are correct. The first part of it is super uncomfortable, but it's meant to be. It's meant to make you feel like, oh, I don't like what's going on here. And the way that it ends, I was like applauding. The way it ended, I loved it because I was like, and I don't want to, you know, and I feel like, her doing the nudity and everything that she did for this film, Emma Stone, she clearly believed in the project. Plus, she's not an ingenue. She's not somebody who's brand spanking new to Hollywood. And she was one of the executive producers of this film. So I felt like she had control over the participation in this and the trust. And then also, I mean, there's the learning to monetize, you know, because that was how she's surviving at one point. You know, being a sex worker. And it's just, I just liked a lot of what it had to say and about the fact that where she ends up. I thought that was really, because there's a horrible, like, we're going to institutionalize her or neutralize her moment that with, you know, with another character that comes back that you didn't know, you know, you didn't know about as more of the backstory of the body unfolds, and that I think is like, you know, in the Victorian era, you didn't like your wife, you called her crazy and put her in an institution. So this all of that, I love how she navigated even the predator. She navigated the predator and ended up like he was trying desperately, you know. I don't know, you know. So
I had a friend who said, oh, I just saw Poor Things, and boy, you know, everybody talks about Barbie being the women empowerment movie. This is the women empowerment movie, and I, oh, man, I have an allergic reaction to that. And I said, you know, surviving being abused and raped and taken advantage of does not make it an empowerment movie. And in a second, I want to compare it to something, but questions for you. This is my question for everyone. How old do you think she was mentally when she left?
Oh, she was definitely under 18. And that, and yes, I totally agree with you, but I also I feel like she's this outside of the norm that is sort of showing a mirror to the norm, you know, like basically like, look at how creepy we are, you know, I like that aspect of it. And I was uncomfortable, but I liked the way it went, the way it, you know, and I just thought, and she was so, even as she becomes more fully formed intellectual, she still does what she wants to do. And that was fabulous.
Yeah, she absolutely does, mm-hmm. but we protect our children from this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. My son, who's 20 years old, started watching this movie, and he's a film student. He started watching this movie, and what he said resonates with me. I hadn't said anything, but I was like, you could tell. I was, mm-hmm. and he said, this movie, it's like somebody said, I want to write a movie where it's okay to have sex with children. How can I get away with that? And that is what this movie is to me. I think it's a way of normalizing. See, young girls like it. It's okay to be predators. Now, here's my example of, if you look at this movie and The Color Purple, they are almost the same movie.
Really?
They are almost the same movie with a couple of big exceptions. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have young women who are being taken advantage of by a male-dominated world where they don't have a say, where they're being raped. You know, and the character has this thing where they are stuck on, you know, and they're trying to say, I want this. But in The Color Purple, she does take ownership of it all. She figures her way out. She turns it around, is able to forgive the people who have abused her, is able to, and in both cases, both women find some normalcy in love with other women, right? But it's just depicted in an entirely different way that isn't salacious in The Color Purple. And where is that in the awards season? Brilliant performances by brilliant women. And it's not the empowerment movie, women empowerment movie of the, excuse me, I beg your pardon. This piece of trash, for me, no. That is not empowerment. Allowing somebody, because... You know, okay, she's not 18 in your mind? Is she 8?
You know, I don't know. I felt like she was more like an adolescent at that point in her development. So, yes.
So that's okay for you?
It is not okay. No, it is not. But this is the thing. That happens. That happens all the time.
Does.
And so we see her having that happen to her and not having, you know, like, not being shamed by the whole thing. I mean, he tries to control her.
Yes.
And he tries to be like, oh, don't fall in love with me, blah, blah, blah. Right. And then he wants to be around her because she's who she is. And she's kind of like, I'm just done with you. I'm bored.
Yeah.
And I like that. And also, it is a fantasy. So she isn't, I don't think it's an indoctrination of, like, it's okay to have sex with children. I don't. I think it's, it was deliberately in a fantasy world where it was familiar as sort of Victorian era London, enough to give us a little distance, but also to give us the social societal mores of that time.
But I feel like the walk away from people is she was enjoying it.
I don't
know. Like, she was taking ownership of it. She wanted it. And that's the thing that I go, guys, that is what we are fighting in court.
Well, but then when she, other sexual experiences she has are not great, and she recognizes, oh, this, you know what I mean? It's like, I felt like it wasn't just she's the sex object. It was her actually going, oh, this is good, this not so much. And I felt, I don't know, it was like divorced from the shame. Is what I saw.
Yes.
Completely
divorced from the shame. But you cannot divorce it for me from her age and her intellectual understanding of the world.
Yeah.
I can't separate that. There's no possibility for me to go, oh, it is okay to put a 14-year-old in this circumstance.
Yeah.
The movie set the premise.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Can't get past it.
All right.
So all right. We agree to disagree.
Agree to disagree.
And we're still talking.
And we're still friends.
I don't know about that. We're friends. Okay.
All right. Last one. Killers of the Flower Moon, directed by Martin Scorsese, starring Lily Gladstone, Leonardo DiCaprio, Robert De Niro, Jesse Plemons, John Lithgow, Brendan Fraser, and a bunch of other folks. So this is based on true events. This is Scorsese working again with DiCaprio and De Niro. The setting is 1920s Oklahoma, where oil has been discovered on Osage land. The Osage people are entitled to the oil rights, so of course white men come in to get their piece of the pie. There is a mention of the Tulsa Massacre, where another moment where white America destroyed what was called Black Wall Street, destroying wealth and prosperity of a non-white group. So we're already kind of like, oh, here we go again. The way they present this story as it unfolds is more insidious. The white men are marrying the Osage women with the oil rights, and then those women are having unexplained illnesses, fatal accidents, and suicides, and therefore the rights go to the surviving husband. De Niro's character speaks the language of the Osage people and is revered and accepted into their world. You can see the racism under it when you hear a couple speaking about mixed race children and how that one can pass and this one can't, you know, that kind of thing. And because these Osage folk are wealthy, they become targets, you know. So there's no subtlety in this story, and I feel like they tipped their hand a little too quickly. I felt like it would have been better study to show the way that they integrated into the Osage society and then took it over like a cancer. I love Martin Scorsese, but boy, oh boy, this was not his best work. The only saving grace of this entire film is Lily Gladstone. She's luminous, and she quietly steals every scene she's in. I love her. I don't know how this is up for Best Picture. I shudder to think what the story was before Scorsese rewrote it, because he rewrote it to focus more on Lily Gladstone's character. And I'm like, even with the rewrite, the focus is still De Niro and DiCaprio. And then Scorsese himself makes a last-minute cameo that's cringeworthy, totally tone-deaf, and I just want to shake him. I want the Scorsese of After Hours, The Departed, Goodfellas, Age of Innocence. I want that Scorsese back. This, blah, did not like it at all.
Okay. But how do you really feel?
How do I really feel?
Okay, and here's the thing. I don't like Martin Scorsese films. I don't think I've ever liked a Martin Scorsese film.
Okay.
He's one of those directors, I understand why people love him, because his viewpoint is so present, right? Mm-hmm. It's just so male that I've always had trouble hanging with his films. Mm. I always, like, it's just whenever he's directing, it's very funny because there's a script contest where, you know, you can submit films, and they have an award that they give for women empowerment films.
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
And here's the criteria for it. It's like you have to have a scene, one scene in your film that has at least two women talking.
Oh, the Bechdel test.
Is that?
Yeah, yeah. Two women talking, and they're named characters, and they're not talking about a man.
Thank you. And I don't think you're ever going to find that in a Scorsese film, and you don't find it in this film.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate that the name of the movie is Killers of the Flower Moon, because that's what it's about. Mm-hmm. I love Joe Coy. Is that what his name is?
The comedian.
He made the joke at the Golden Globes. He was like, you know, you appropriated this film just like you appropriated their money.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's taken over by the men. Even in the, there were so many opportunities in this film where she had her sisters, and we could have seen the culture. The one scene that we have with her sisters, they sit on a log at the, like, picnic and look at the boys.
Yeah.
Here's what's really wrong about this film for me. Is that here you have Leonardo DiCaprio, who's considered a sex symbol. Like, you know, I don't think he's the best looking guy on the planet, but, you know, he's able to sell himself as a warm, charming kind of guy. I saw no reason why this woman who had power and money would have picked him.
Mm-hmm.
Scorsese didn't bother to show us how he wooed her. He drove her twice and then put his arm around her, and supposedly she was, mm-hmm. No, excuse me. Mm-hmm. Like, do the work, Martin, and show us how she fell for him. Make him put in a little bit of effort. Because I was like, what? Why would she even, like, you see this happening, and here is this guy who is a nothing burger. Mm-hmm. He revealed himself to you the first time. Why are you giving him the time of day?
Yeah.
Made no sense to me whatsoever. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what a sad, sad reality. And I guess I'm glad that Martin showed us, because I didn't know about this.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know about this community and what was done to them. And I guess, you know, mm-hmm. I have to say, out of all of his movies, I hated this one a little less.
A little, okay.
Because of Lily Gladstone and because I think criticism in the past where, you know, in The Irishman where it was like, you know, did he let the women say five words in the whole movie?
Right.
Like, women didn't exist at this time.
Right.
You know, she got a little bit more screen time.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate that this is groundbreaking. Mm-hmm. It's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, Native American women have not had the opportunity to shine in films. It's just like, what?
Well, I know.
What year is this?
I know.
So I hope that it will move the dial in terms of that. But no, I didn't think it was Best Picture.
No.
And, I thought that Robert De Niro did a really good performance, but I didn't even think that Leo, it was like he was phoning it in.
Well, yeah, and he had that, like, real, like, frowny face look. You
like,
know, I'd be
real attracted to that.
Yeah, it was odd, and then, but one of the things my daughter says this, she says that Scorsese likes women, he just doesn't know how to write them. And she says, Quentin Tarantino does not like women.
I think
that's an interesting distinction, and I've become more observant of, like, how are these women being depicted, you know, and what kind of screen time do they get, and is it all through just the male eye?
Well, and here's
the
thing that's funny for me. I when I've had criticism for Scorsese about this before in the past, they're like, well, you know, he's a male director, and he's going to tell the story how he wants to tell it. And, you know, mm-hmm. when a woman director, and I'm like, yes, when they allow that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, let's look at Barbie.
Mm-hmm.
If Barbie had just women and Ken was barely there, even as it is, people freaked out.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, well, and Ken had a great role.
And that was the thing. Even with Barbie, which was all about Barbie, there was plenty of space for Ken. Look at that. This is how you write it, guys.
Because they're always there.
It's the main character is Barbie, but she's not in a vacuum. It's like, and that's where a lot of the, you know, male-driven stuff, I'm like, where are the women? They're on the phone going, come back soon, honey.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it's like
Oppenheimer. Hello. Like, honestly.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel bad for the women trying to promote it when they're out promoting it. It's like, you were barely in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
Give me a
break. Yeah.
Brilliant, brilliant actresses wasted in that movie because, you know, because there wasn't anybody alive or
Can you imagine, though, the first draft of Killers of the Flower Moon?
Yeah, I mean, I made the mistake of saying something in a forum about when it came out and it said, oh, you know, Lily Gladstone in this movie. And I said, oh, well, you know, hopefully he'll let her speak more than five lines. And all the Scorsese men were like, you know, he writes fabulous roles for women. And I was like, where, when, how, and they were, you know, all of these things. And I went, oh, okay, I can't even have this conversation with you people. Mm-hmm. Because it's not who he writes for.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that everybody thinks that that's brilliant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like Scorsese. I have always liked Scorsese, but I feel like The Irishman was, and I was not as enamored of that. And looking back, there's other films, I'm like, well, you know, he did give the women, they were still secondary, but there were meatier roles in the older films that he did. So, you know, I don't know.
So
I don't know.
My cup of tea.
Yeah.
We all have things that we like and we don't like. That's what I like about doing this because we can, you know, have different tastes.
Right.
And like different things, and it's just, you know, it's not an indictment.
Right.
It's, you know,
right.
You like things or you don't like things.
Mm-hmm.
But I will be interested to see. I'm not as interested in the, we're going to do an Oscar show.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not as interested in the Oscars this year. I'm not. Mm-hmm. Because I feel like some of the things that I felt should have been acknowledged just weren't.
Mm-hmm.
The Color Purple, I don't understand it at all.
Mm.
I know you haven't seen it yet.
Yeah.
For me, it's Best Picture. For me, I do not understand why Taraji P. Henson has not gotten award nominations, other than the fact that Danielle Brooks is getting nominations, and Danielle Brooks deserves them and deserves to win.
Mm-hmm.
But Taraji P. Henson, I've watched it twice now.
Mm.
That's a great performance.
Oh, wow. If I ever meet
Taraji, I don't know whether the studio pulled back and said, look, we can't have two women battling it out in the Best Supporting, like we'll lose ground, and if they just didn't.
Yeah.
And if they talked to Taraji about it, I'd like to think that that's the case. And she went, I've won awards. Let Danielle have this. But it was,
Well, it is. And that's the other thing, because the Oscars and all these award shows, they're marketing vehicles. You know, I mean, we know this. But I've still loved the process of it. I'm disappointed, as you are, with some of the choices and non-choices.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and I think it's going to be interesting. I don't know if expanding Best Picture to 10 pictures was a good thing or a bad thing. Maybe it gave opportunity to some things that would not have had that otherwise, because it's kind of like, oh, here are the 5 best directors, therefore there are the 5 best pictures.
Right.
You know, that was kind of the way it used to be. So now it mixes it up a little bit, but, yeah, it's going to be an interesting – I'll watch it. I'm having my gathering –
and
I'm going to figure out the food.
Yes. Tell people, because I don't think people know what you do.
I like to have an Oscar party, and actually I stole this from my friend who did Super Bowl parties. When she would do a Super Bowl party, she would pick food from each of the teams that were playing. So, and in one, I'm terrible with football, so I won't know. But, you know, just whatever was, in New England, it's clam chowder or whatever. And she did that, and I thought, I should do that for, like, the Best Picture nods.
Right.
And so I've been trying to – actually, I haven't figured out anything. So, yeah, put in the comments what I should do for the different Best Picture nods. What – I mean, Killers of the Flower Moon, what would I serve? I don't know of any – they didn't really focus on the food or there was – I don't know. But – Barbie, I guess I'll just do pink cupcakes, right?
Well, you're gonna have a good time with Zone of Interest.
Yeah.
That will be a horrible little
Zone of Interest. Yeah, I don't even know that I want to acknowledge, with anything.
Yeah.
Cause I just feel like it would veer into very bad taste. So
there we go.
Yeah.
But
I'll
there
be
we go with that.
Yeah, maybe I'll make a donation to the Holocaust Museum. That's what I'll do. That'll be my nod to the Zone of Interest.
So we will be doing our Oscar special that week before. I don't know that we've absolutely set a date.
Mm-hmm.
But, and anything that we haven't covered, we'll make sure that we've covered. Because I think there's a couple of Best Pictures that we haven't covered.
Yes.
I also have been watching the shorts. I've only gotten 3 of the live action shorts, but oh my gosh, you guys, you got to be watching this. They're so good.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely amazing. My doors. I watched one. I was like, well, surely that's going to win. Then I watched the next one. And I went, oh my gosh, no, that'll win.
Mm-hmm.
And then we watched the third one, and my son and I were like, I don't know. It's really hard. Going to be hard. And I've started watching the animated ones. So I just want to tell people to watch Nimona.
Yeah, I want to watch that now that we've spoken of it. I've only seen Elemental in the animation category.
I haven't seen Elemental.
Yeah, that's – I don't know if you have Disney Plus, but it's on that.
I just haven't watched it yet. But it will – we had the discussion around our table the other day about that this award season will chart how Disney moves in the future, because Elemental is the movie that they stuck behind – and they've pushed.
Mm-hmm.
Nimona was the movie that they made and kind of pulled out of.
That's what I need to see then,
But they're both nominated.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I need to see it, because I've seen Nimona, and it's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
I want to see Elemental.
Yeah.
But I do want to tell people, make sure you watch. It's on Netflix, the short film, The After, Buckle Up.
Okay.
David Oyelowo.
Woo! Woo! Love him.
Yeah. There we go.
For you film buffs, I'm going to tell you the secret. The Rollo Tomasi, that's from L.A. Confidential. I love that film. And then this is, of course, the carpet in The Shining.
There's
my film nerd outfit for the day.
I love it. I can't wait to see what you wear for the Oscars. Last year you wore...
I wore eyeballs for the little googly eyes for everything everywhere all at once.
And then it was like, I don't know, 2 months later, we were sitting here in the chairs. Dr. Grant Pichet was sitting there, and she reached in and she found a little googly eye. She's like, where has this come from? And I didn't remember.
You didn't remember?
And I was like, I don't know. And she was like, it's like...
This means something.
Yeah. That's what it was. Anyway, so we will be back in a couple of weeks with our Oscar show. We hope that you watch and enjoy movies and figure out what you like and what you don't like and what makes your head spin and move around the room.
Mm-hmm.
But make sure you check out TACA, T-A-C-A now.
.org.
Mm-hmm. And see what's happening there. We'll be back tomorrow with a live Ask Dr. Doreen, and I know I'm looking forward to that and not coughing through the whole thing. Thank you guys for being with us and sticking with us when we lost our connection for a minute.
And I know when we were duking it out.
Yes. Hopefully Moira's still speaking to me when the camera's off.
Of course.
All right. We'll see you guys next time. Until then, give your kiddos a hug from me and one for you, too. Bye-bye for now.